Everybody get up, it's time to slam now. We got the real jam going down. Welcome to the Space Jam. Space Jam. Here's your chance, do your dance at the Space Jam. Alright.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the extended preview for this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie. I'm one of your hosts, Bob Mackey. Very happy Bosco's done in the Space Jam. How about you?
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert flinging it from the three-point line.
And you're about to hear a free preview of our longest What a Cartoon Movie to date.
Oh, yeah.
And part of that is because we have a very special guest on the history segment, don't we?
Yes, that's right. Let's say it up front, but you'll hear him in his plugs after this, too. Thad Komorowski, who we've had on for multiple episodes of What a Cartoon, because he knows so much about classic animation. He insisted to be on the history part, and he shared so much with us. That really helped us understand the context that the Looney Tunes were in at the time as a brand and how Warner Brothers was using them when 1996 rolled around. And also, whenever I was like, oh, it was like that one classic cartoon, and I could just like count on Thad to go like, oh, is this one from 47?
Hair in my soup. That's just an example. But yeah. Yes, so this special preview will talk about the history segment of that podcast. But if you want to hear the full thing, including a full discussion of the movie, the sort of play-by-play thing we do with all of our shows that we cover, please go to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons and sign up. At the $10 level, you get that entire nearly 5 hours of that podcast. But also every What a Cartoon Movie we've done to date. What is that, like over 80 hours now of podcasts?
I think this puts it over 80, yeah.
Yeah, and then also you'll get all the $5 stuff, which again, too much to list here, but just all the miniseries, all the interviews we've done, everything we've done for the past 3+ years, you get instantly for signing up at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons.
Yeah, that back catalog of What a Cartoon Movie is too long to list, but I mean, if you enjoy this 90s nostalgia of a classic cartoon character, I think you'll also really enjoy the one we did for A Goofy Movie. Plus, if you liked all the talk about the internal machinations at Warner Animation Theatrical, you'll learn a ton more about that in our one for Iron Giant. As well, if you like other classics, you should definitely check out our ones on Toy Story and Toy Story 2. Those were really in-depth, a lot of stuff that is not public knowledge even by regular cartoon fans. And yeah, not to toot our own horn on this one too much, but I do think this is like one of the funniest ones we've done too.
We question the bizarre logic of this movie constantly, and it's been it was a lot of fun to record.
And just to reflect on the acting ability of Michael Jordan to bask in that sunlight.
I'll give you a preview. Come on, Henry. Cut it out.
I don't like fun.
He's a whimsical man, and we all love him.
But yeah, I guess, you know, that's set up. Please, $10 a month, you'll get to hear the whole thing and all the $5 stuff, patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. But I guess why don't we just slam and jam into our history discussion of Space Jam. Well, Thad, why don't we, at the start here, though, let's tell everybody about your cool stuff. You know, you're an animation historian who has so much to share with us on this, and you do that on your own podcast and Patreon.
Yes, I do a podcast with animation legend Bob Jakes. It's called Cartoon Logic. We discuss all of the theatrical and early TV cartoons in depth. We just did a Roadrunner episode this week at the time of this recording in early June, and we're going to be doing a second Walter Lantz and Woody Woodpecker episode after that. And we also have, as part of our Patreon, as an exclusive, we are breaking down the Fleischer Popeyes year by year. Our first episode of 1933 is up there, and by the time this airs, we should have our 1934 episode. You know, we've got at least another 5 or 6 episodes before they really start to take water, but, you know, Bob is the one animator who obsessively studied Fleischer Popeye intensely, so he's the guy to go to for any information about the series. So it's definitely a good history record.
Nice.
Which is why I appreciate some of the stuff you guys are doing with Simpsons people, because it's a history record.
If people even know the animators on things, it's like director level at that, at best.
And it's good that we're getting them before they're too old to not remember things, because it feels like everyone was interviewed like in the 70s when they were near death from the old animation era. It's like,
I remember drawing a Betty Boop or two.
Yeah. Oh, they're all over the place. If anyone actually got a hold of Dave Fleischer to interview him, there's a rather famous story, historian Mike Barrier. To this day, he has not transcribed his interview with Dave Fleischer because it's useless.
Oh, that's sad.
I mean, Wilbur Cobb from Ren and Stimpy, the first time we meet him, he is like the decaying animation legend that makes no sense and is just screaming Walter Lance. So whenever I see Walter Lance's name or hear it, I just think, Walter Lance!
Yeah. But well, Bob Camp succeeded then. So.
Well, okay, why don't we go into the history of how Space Jam came to be? It is a complicated and long one, both on the live action and animation halves of this movie. But let's first do a quick history on the two co-stars. And honestly, this could be a four-hour podcast just talking about the history of Bugs Bunny, but I'm going to try to be quick on it. Bugs Bunny, he officially first appeared in Tex Avery's A Wild Hare, though there are definitely some doppelgangers of Bugs before that cartoon. I write that.
Correct. And he was never called Happy Rabbit. And if you say that, I will give you a lead pipe massage.
Isn't there like a Bugs Hardaway sort of mix up there too, Thad? Like he wasn't the creator or he wasn't named after him?
He co-directed the first cartoon, Porky's Hare Hunt, and then it went on to a Disney designer guy, Charlie Thorson, did a new design of the rabbit, and it was for Bugs Hardaway, so he put it on the model sheet, Bugs is Bunny, and Bugs means crazy, so the studio publicity picked up on it and said, oh, he's Bugs Bunny, and there it went. And Tex Avery never liked the name. He wanted to call him Jack Rabbit.
I think with Bugs Bunny's, it's more commercial. Gotta give it to Bugs.
Yeah, like, I think it's so weird that I always forget what his name means. Like, Bugs, as in, like, Bughouse crazy, as in, like, Nuthouse crazy. So, like, that's where, it's all ableist, is what I'm saying. So, Daffy Duck canceled. Bugs Bunny canceled.
Oh, no. Just the duck and the bunny now.
Yes. We can't talk about them anymore.
Bugs would quickly become, you know, the marquee star of the Warner shorts that would appear before. For their many live action films. You know, Warner had a whole bunch of cartoons before that. Porky predates him by like, what, four or five years?
Yeah.
And Daffy before that too, which I know that because I fell in love with the character of Daffy as my favorite Looney Tune because I watched the 50th anniversary of Bugs special on TV, and the running story in it is that Daffy is mad that he had a 50th anniversary 2 years earlier that no one celebrated.
Aw. I was there.
I prefer the jealous Daffy. I'm more into jealous evil Daffy than Daffy, actually crazy one. But anyway, Bugs becomes the biggest star of them. He's in over 150 shorts on his own alongside a growing collection of Looney Tunes, legendary shorts directed by folks like Tex Avery, Bob Clampett, Chuck Jones, Bob McKimson, Frank Tashlin, Friz Freleng, and many, many more. Animated works of genius that entertain and inspire millions to this day. Like they are, it's hard to overstate how amazing just the entire production of Termite Terrace was back then. And also, you know, Bugs, when you compare him to his rival at the Disney studio, Mickey Mouse, who, you know, started as a kind of devilish, fun character, quickly became, you know, safer and more suburban. Meanwhile, you have Bugs with his like New York dialect and self-aware delivery that is owes more than a little to Groucho Marx. He really stood out for Mickey as this
nobody likes Mickey Mouse.
Did you guys realize by the end of this decade there will be more years of The Simpsons than there were years of Looney Tunes?
Wow.
Yeah. Holy shit, you're right.
it's gonna happen. It will.
And they're all going to sound like Mel Blanc in about 10 years.
Oh, they're getting
Mel Blanc circa 1988.
Now. Yeah. There's all these popular Looney Tunes, but the merry-go-round breaks down in the mid-60s. They stop original productions. You know, Cool Cat kills them off pretty much.
Oh, God, yeah. It all ends with engine trouble.
And Bugs is still used, but pretty sparingly in original stuff. It's more in marketing things or in reruns endlessly on television of the many shorts. You know, three shorts can easily have two commercials between between them, and there you go. You got a half hour of television. And so that's how that the Gen X generation knows Looney Tunes, mainly thanks to all of those reruns. Plus, you know, the rare new footage they'd make of the Looney Tunes was usually for like compilation films, like the Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner movie or the aforementioned Quackbusters.
I was never more heartbroken than when I would rent those as a kid at the video store. Like, they made a Looney Tunes movie and I've never seen it, and then it was just like 3% new footage.
I think the Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner one, that was the propaganda that made me like a Chuck Jones lover, because it is so like the Jonesy, it's the Jonesiest one. And also,
well,
it's
the Jones self tribute.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
All his best, it's all his best films in one package.
And also, I mean, the Coyote stuff, it's all just cut together like it's one long short, and it's kind of just the greatest hits, right? It's not even the short individually.
No, it's just the greatest hits thing, and it's very tedious. I don't know what Jones's thinking was for a 19-minute Roadrunner.
We are. We just mentioned Quackbusters before, the 1989, I think, like kind of clip show movie. Mm-hmm. I like the original content in that one better. And in fact, I think it has like the most original content of that era.
That was Greg Ford and Terry Lennon. Terry Lennon is an animator, and Greg Ford is one of the animation historian forefathers. I mean, he's still around. He's still in New York. I see him from time to time when I'm there. Mm. You know, he was carrying the gospel of Looney Tunes through the 70s, through the dark ages. And, you know, he really understood what made those characters work. And there was a period of about 1988, which is when they did Quackbusters, to about 92, I think. He was doing a lot of low budget stuff, but it was pretty true to the characters, I would think. You know, they are using the later Chuck Jones and Mike Maltese incarnations of the characters, but I grew up with them. I still like them, even if I'm looking at them objectively now and not from a nostalgic factor. It's Quackbusters, he was at least trying to tell a story. And he actually had a couple of the animators, like Mark Kosler and Dan Haskett, you know, they animate them to look like they do in the cartoons that they're linking the footage to.
There's some actually good connective tissue in that. Yeah, that's true. And who can say no to hearing Mel Torme sing through Daffy Duck's body? But so by the time the 80s were nearing their end, things changed in a big way for animation overall. And this is a whole other podcast we could do. But Who Framed Roger Rabbit was released, and it celebrated U.S. animation history in a way no mainstream film, I think, had ever done before. And the novelty of seeing the cartoons interact with live action and also with each other in crossover ways you'd never seen before, like Bugs meets Mickey Mouse, Daffy meets Donald, these things you dreamed of as a kid coming true in a spectacularly animated film and a like visual delight of a also just a really good like noir film. I think that really refreshed the popularity of the art form, and Bugs Bunny's profile in particular was really raised back up, I think, thanks to the success of that movie.
Oh yeah, he's only in it for about 30 seconds, but everybody liked him better than they did like Roger.
When you see him for a second, you're like, oh, I've been watching a White Rabbit imitation of this great guy.
That's the better rabbit.
After the success of Roger Rabbit, you know, the Looney Tunes were getting marketed more than ever. I remember on my VHS for the Batman 1989 film, here's Bugs Bunny telling me about how awesome the Warner Brother catalog is.
What a shill.
Plus, the Looney Tunes reruns were getting bigger ratings than ever. When they got repackaged on Nickelodeon, they were getting record ratings. Like,
yeah.
There was a story of them shutting down all the phones in America with an 800 number, like, for a contest that was happening on Nickelodeon.
It's so funny because like our boomer parents grew up with this old entertainment as their TV programming, like old cartoons from the 40s and 50s as what they would watch on TV. Then like 30 years later, we are watching it on Nickelodeon, we're watching it on ABC, on TBS, on TNT. Like, there's like four places to see Looney Tunes.
Also, the censors were kind of lax and some stuff got through that I had a good laugh in my class where I brought in my Bugs Bunny tape to watch in like a third grade class. And there came up the joke, I believe it's in the one where he fights the gremlin, where he turns into a jackass and it says jackass on screen. And my teacher was like shocked and there was just nervous titters throughout the room.
Your Arkansas class really loved Cole Black.
I did not bring my band seven there.
That was out of circulation by 1988.
1968, it is, as a matter of fact. It was MLK's assassination that created that censored 11.
Oh, wow.
Makes sense. Yeah. Makes sense, yeah.
But I will say, I'm kind of amazed they survived and endured on network television because of how much they would excise from the cartoons. I mean, you know, as someone who works with these legacy characters, I can tell you that the debate over Elmer Fudd's gun, yeah, I'm going to mention it just briefly, but it comes and goes every 5 years. I mean, this is nothing new. Mm-hmm. I mean, it has, well, the environment of America and gun use definitely is impacting it, but it comes and goes every 5 years. But going back to the late 60s and 70s, they were cutting out all the gun use in those cartoons. Mm.
I mean, something like
Rabbit Fire or Rabbit Seasoning would be completely incoherent.
Well, those just can't air. It's all gunshots.
Yeah,
it's
just all in the face, too.
Well, they would cut to a shot of Bugs while the gun went off.
Yeah. And then it felt like there were so many different cuts that it was sort of like a Mandela effect. Like, did I remember this gag having a different punchline, or did I remember this scene that's not here? Like, where's the scene that I wanted to see? Like, there were so many different versions of these.
Did it have a war in it?
Yeah.
Well, and lastly, on the rebuilding of his legacy and celebrating Bugs' legacy, there was Tiny Toons riding that same wave, also from Amblin.
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, Bugs and the other Looney Tunes, they're more like recurring characters in Tiny Toons. But it's all about Bugs teaching the next generation of Toons, who have now gone away. Like, they don't exist anymore, and Bugs is still here. Buster is not teaching the new generation of Tiny Toons these days. He's just gone.
And 96 is like the tail end of the WB prestige cartoon era. Like, mm-hmm. they're just running out of steam and realizing anime is cheaper. Or on the brink of realizing that.
And all right, now let's talk about his co-star in this film. Born in 1963, Michael Jeffrey Jordan was already cementing his legacy as arguably, though most would say inarguably, the greatest basketball player of all time before he was even 30 by 1992. Like, he had, in 1982, helped win the NCAA title for North Carolina, drafted to the Chicago Bulls in 1984, a team at the time that was struggling for recognition. Like, they were not a popular team. Their games were lowly attended, and people figured Jordan would just kind of just crap out there. But he had this remarkable ability as a team captain, a dunker, a shooter, and he was just doing things on the court you'd never seen before. He became instantly popular, like a superstar, and also one of the most marketable athletes of his day and perhaps ever. Like, he broke the mold on how NBA players made endorsement deals, starting in 1984 when he got his own shoe with Nike. Because the thinking back then was, as at least this is what documentaries have told me, the thinking back then was that in basketball, the star is the team. You don't sell as much the individual players, and that was more for like solo sports like boxing or tennis. But Jordan was being marketed as a singular star beyond the Bulls and beyond the NBA. And he credits his super agent David Falk for making him so marketable. He's a very pushy guy who is making all these deals, and he took advantage of Jordan's just celebrity of being a huge bankable star, and first made the deal with Nike for Air Jordans, which became instantly the best-selling shoe on the market. And like, Air Jordans became bigger than shoes themselves. Like, they changed society. Like, Air Jordans were that big.
Yeah, I mean, the propaganda worked on me as a kid who didn't care about sports, didn't like playing them because I was terrible. Like, I did watch basketball for a few years, probably because of like, who is this Michael Jordan guy? He's like the Superman of basketball players.
Yeah, he would also, even if you didn't watch a single NBA game, he was in so many commercials for everything. You just see him everywhere. If you saw a McDonald's commercial, you saw him. Gatorade, Wheaties, Nikes, everything. Like, any company that could afford him would have Michael Jordan do a commercial for it. And And as his skills grew, he only got more marketable. And by 1991, he led the Bulls to their first championship, which would then go on to be a three-peat. They would win three in a row, which, you know, rarely done in the NBA.
It's really funny that he is the lead of this movie. A lot is, you know, being put on his shoulders. And I think the appeal of these commercials he was in, he didn't say a lot. And when he did, he was just like charmingly awkward in a personable way. It brought this mega millionaire, like super basketball player down to earth, because he was kind of like a clumsy, awkward guy.
Yeah.
Personally. So it's funny that he is now like the star of a movie.
No, I mean, when you compare him to, you know, other transcendent athlete stars, like, I don't know, like Babe Ruth or before him, like Babe Ruth had, I guess he had a bigger personality, I'd say.
I would say like a more modern comparison would be Larry Johnson, who I think he's in this movie.
Yes.
And he was much more charismatic on screen. He was much more like a flamboyant. Like Dennis Rodman, too. Like Michael Jordan is not that.
No, Shaq is a better actor than him. Like,
that's
true. Not that Shaq's a great actor. But.
And little known Bob Mackie trivia, I bought a Larry Johnson jersey in 1994, still in my closet.
Wow.
I just held on to it. I'm like, this is kind of neat. I'll never buy another one of these.
Or, I mean, he also wasn't like Muhammad Ali, being like he was not political.
Yeah.
He was a very mainstream kind of guy. But so Jordan, big star by the early 1992. It's a time to start selling the seventh iteration of Air Jordans. And how are they going to shake up that marketing? Well, what if he were to team up for a Super Bowl commercial with a certain Rascally Rabbit?
Rascally Rabbit.
Of course you know this means war. Jordan.
Who'd you expect? Elmer Fudd?
Yep.
Yeah, that was the late Greg Burson right there as Bugs right there.
I was just going to ask which Bugs is that, because I do like that Bugs more than the Billy West Bugs.
Oh.
That
we're
getting. Greg Burson was a tragic story. He pretty much drank himself out of a career.
Oh.
He also did a hell of a good Dawes Butler Yogi Bear as well.
That's unfortunate, man. So that wasn't Noel Blank then there.
No. Noel only did like a couple of little things. I think he might have been on Tiny Toons once or twice. He did Taz to very poor effect in an early episode. You know, you hope that the kid will inherit the genes, and Mel tried to push him, but you know, it didn't work out. It wasn't his calling, and whatever. It doesn't mean he's a failure as a human being.
No.
He's no Brian Henson.
hey, Sweetums is a good, I like Brian Henson. He's a good performer. But Hair Jordan commercial was a giant hit. Like, it clearly inspired by the Roger Rabbit things too. It's just Bugs is pulled into the real world playing against real players who are being jerks, and he teams up with Michael Jordan to defeat them in comical fashion. It aired during Super Bowl 26, directed by Joe Pitka, who was very famous at the time for directing a lot of high-profile ads of the 80s and into the 90s. Like, if it was a million-dollar ad, it was probably Joe Pitka. And he also directed the gambling classic Let It Ride, starring Richard Dreyfuss. If you ever seen that was a favorite of my dad, because he loved the ponies. But the animation side of it, I believe, was done at Warner's then small Classics division, which was separate from TV, and you know, normally tasked with drawing the characters and ads, though this definitely seemed a lot more ambitious than the, you know, simple drawings of Bugs promoting the Warner catalog that I talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The ad was so popular that it led to a sequel that would go the next Super Bowl at Super Bowl 27, only this time it would be inversed, where it was pretty much all animated and Jordan was the only live action element in it. Here's a quick clip from that one.
Pebble Beach.
This is no way for a pampered superstar to travel.
What the?
And they're all mine.
Give me those, Air Jordan.
Now, yes, 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 now, no, no, no. Take these or else. That makes me angry.
I also want to say that these are the early 90s ads, and it felt like in the early 90s there was a cynical but effective push of these characters onto a more urban demographic, urban in quotes, meaning black people. Mm-hmm. So you would see, you know, Bugs palling around with a black basketball player, and also all of those shirts that are like, the Taz is wearing crisscross
yes,
gear.
Yeah.
Like Daffy's like a DJ scratching up and on these giant t-shirts that everybody in the 90s had.
I love those t-shirts. Yeah. I had those same t-shirts. I never had a sassy Tweety Bird one with his arms crossed and his upside down cap, but
Tweety is like the Karen mascot these days. But yeah, it did feel like, let's get other people into Looney Tunes, and this is a huge part of it with the star power of Michael Jordan. So I felt like you saw more than just little white kids in the Looney Tunes around this time.
Well, you know, Disney is such a white bread company by comparison that if I'm a marketer at Warner, I'm like, these Looney Tunes can speak differently to a different demographic than the Disney princesses and Winnie the Pooh stuff, you know?
The Warner cartoons were always urban. I mean, they took Bugs right out of Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And so much of the animation and music style was influenced by jazz. Mm-hmm. So, it fits.
I'm looking at one of the official ones, and yeah, like Taz and Bugs are on the shirt. Their hats are on backwards. Bugs has an earring. Their pants are extremely saggy, and they're on backwards.
Nice.
So you got everything going on there.
Coolest dude.
They should do one with Big Chungus like that.
Oh, man.
Absolutely, they need to. They got to get marketing more on that Chungus already, man.
The cartoon that's from, Wabbitwubble, on the WB Kids channel, they use the Big Chungus Bugs in the preview images.
Wow.
Specifically, and they use them twice.
That is smart, man. They jumped on that meme fast. But yeah, that sequel commercial was for the Air Jordan 8, and it featured, you know, Bugs teaming up with Michael Jordan to play against the Instant Martians to try to defeat Marvin and K-9, which they do in under 90 seconds and save the day. There's always a funny bit at the end of both of them of, like, Jordan cutting off, he does the "that's all, folks," and Porky gets kind of mad about that.
Oh, one thing I just realized is that, so these commercials and I think like the cool like urban bug shirts were so popular, of course, that influenced and led to Space Jam. But also a year before Space Jam, there was a Looney Tunes basketball video game that was an NBA Jam ripoff. So like a year before Space Jam, it was awful, but it's just like the t-shirts.
Oh, really?
You saw.
I love that game as a kid.
I mean, we all love things as kids, but there's a reason why there's no revival of that, but there have been several NBA Jam revivals.
People want Windy City Heat back. They want that.
Not a bad game. Actually, Amy Henning, the Uncharted lady, former Uncharted lady, she was like director of that game.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that, man. Okay, so some months after that commercial aired in 93, the tragedy struck. Jordan's father, James, was murdered in a shocking manner. Like, it cast a dark shadow over Michael right after he had won his third championship, you know, and simultaneously there were these new rumors spreading about, you know, Michael Jordan having a real vice for gambling, and some people were wondering, like, is this related to it? Like, what's going on with Michael? Are things, as you know, not as nice as they seem in the commercials? All that stacking up on Jordan, and in October he announced his retirement from the NBA, said he would not be coming back, and instead planned to play baseball professionally. He thought he'd get to play for the Chicago White Sox, but instead got put on their minor league team for a season, where the Barons, and he worked his way up there. There's a whole doc called Jordan Rides the Bus about his time learning to play baseball at a professional level. I actually went to one of those Barons games.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Michael Jordan playing made minor league baseball attendance explode anytime he'd come to town to play your local team. So I went to the Jacksonville Suns versus the Barons, and it was just all people. Well, also, like, in a lot of minor league markets like mine in Jacksonville, we didn't have an NBA team. So you never get the celebrity of Michael Jordan coming to your town. Now you could at a minor league baseball game, of all things.
It felt like he was trying to pivot to a Bo Jackson sort of stardom.
Mm, yeah, yeah. Well, and of course there's a conspiracy theory that he was, you know, shadow banned from the NBA as punishment for a year. Some people say that's not. Definitely Jordan directly refutes that, as does the commissioner of the NBA at the time. All right, so Jordan is in the minor leagues. done with basketball. Those commercials, giant hits. As Agent David Falk tells it, which, you know, how much should we trust an agent on this? But as he tells it, after the second commercial was huge, it was him who pitched to Warner Brothers to make a full film version of these commercials, a feature-length movie that would star Bugs Bunny and Michael Jordan. You know, Warner very quickly picked up the idea. Pitka, who directed both commercials, he was going to come on as director. Ivan Reitman would be the producer. Ivan Reitman, famous for big-budget comedies like Ghostbusters.
Yeah. It's why Bill Murray's in this movie, right?
Yes, yeah. he literally says, "I'm friends with the producer." So,
oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And also, you know, Reitman has animation connections, too. He was a producer on the, you know, animated classic Heavy Metal. He's a producer on that. Do you know his involvement in that one, Thad? I would assume.
No, I don't, unfortunately.
I would assume he's just the liaison who got, like, John Candy to do a voice in it and other comedy people. But yes, Ivan Reitman, though some stories I see actually kind of say that Reitman was the real director of the film and just kind of took over, especially once the live action stuff was done and he was the real guy overseeing it. And also there were things I read that said, oh, Pitka wasn't really ready for this level of a production and was kind of out of his element, and he relied more on his cinematographer Michael Chapman, who's worked on a lot of Scorsese films and other major movies. I don't know, I mean, that Pitka,
no,
guy,
Pitka was really out of it. A lot of the animators speak very vehemently about that he had no idea what he was doing. He had no idea how to place the actors so the animation would actually work. So a lot of stuff had to be redone.
I mean, yeah. It wasn't surprising to me to look at IMDb and see he hadn't directed a movie after this. He just went right back to commercials and music videos. And now it's just a rich guy who, like, one of the most recent stories I read about him was he bought, like, the world's most expensive truffle and ate it at his restaurant.
Sounds unfulfilling.
Oh, great.
As production was beginning at Warner, Warner was in an interesting place. We talked a bit about this in our Iron Giant one, too. But, you know, Disney had their renaissance going strong in the early 90s. Like, they controlled feature animation. Man, Warner was kind of left with their pants down around their ankles. Like, they were meeting Disney and even beating them in a lot of ways on television. But when it came to features, they really weren't ready for it. Like, they kind of had to just restart it. One of the saddest things is that they distributed it, but, like, Rover Dangerfield was their first answer to it. Several animators on this film worked on Rover Dangerfield as well.
I've heard that movie gets no respect. Is that true?
No respect. None at all.
No regard either.
Well, here's the thing with the Warner Animation, for features anyway, is they didn't... this is the problem with animation in the U.S. Disney has such a stranglehold on not just the market, but the influence. And, Warner should have came up with their own identity. But instead, they're trying to ape Disney, not just in tone, but in their acting and motion style and all of that, too. So, you know, why would you go and see a fake Disney? They're going to go see a Don Bluth movie if they wanted to do that.
Yeah, I mean, why? Yeah, Rover Dangerfield, Pagemaster, Quest for Camelot, like these... Those are them trying to be Disney. Space Jam, you know, does stand out by being more of a Warner feeling film, or like separate from the Disney feel comparatively, I'd say.
You know, Cats Don't Dance.
Yes, also that too. But who saw that movie? It's not even on HBO Max. You know?
I had to get it on YouTube to watch it a few months ago.
Warner Archive did put that movie out.
That's good. But
I think it's in a two-pack with Quest for Camelot. Sorry.
Also, another thing that I think hurt their feature was that they merged with Turner around the same time, and Turner had its own feature animation, and they couldn't, splicing those together, they didn't know what they wanted there either. It just made things, like, Cats Don't Dance was a Turner movie first, and that's also what, like, screwed it over. And they also, at the same time, they were trying to figure out how to make Iron Giant, and they wouldn't get that figured out for another 3 years after this. But yeah, so that's where Warner Feature Animation is at. And then Warner makes this deal with Michael Jordan to make a feature-length commercial, and they're like, shit, we got to animate this, and we don't have a studio. And so I think pretty much they just took whoever, some folks who were working on Camelot, some folks who were working on Cats Don't Dance, and the commercials, and then just started hiring on side people as well.
What was animated by several studios, even including at least one that isn't credited?
Well, there are four credited writers on this film, but they were even, like, they were writing while filming. The script was incredibly amorphous, according to multiple things I read. And they did all of the Jordan scenes, or at least the majority of them. Now, who knows about pickups, but during the off season of 1995. And it was also around the same time in 95 that you kind of get a test for what Space Jam could be, because McDonald's was doing an ad campaign with NBA All-Stars for like commemorative cups with the Looney Tunes with other players. And it's a whole nother story about how McDonald's had to start going with Warner stuff because they lost Disney to Burger King.
That's right.
Several players who would later be in Space Jam appear with Michael Jordan in this commercial. Here, I've got another quick clip of that.
McDonald's presents the NBA Looney Tunes All-Star Showdown.
Oh, McDonald's all pretty tail.
Birdie.
He's seeing Larry Bird birds over his head.
If you're still drinking from one of these cups, please stop. It's giving you cancer.
I think the glass Batman Forever cups are still good.
Yeah.
They're still good.
It's not that plastic that biodegrades and enters your bloodstream.
But yeah, I mean, when you watch those commercials, they do feel like a test ground for Space Jam. Like they're over a year before the movie comes out, but it's all of the Looney Tunes playing around with all the players who will be in the movie. And that's because David Falk represents all those players. So that's why you don't see Reggie Miller or Dennis Rodman in this movie or other star players, because they weren't repped by David Falk.
Dennis Rodman is a Looney Tune.
He should be in this movie. He absolutely should, yeah. So yeah, also if you see some of the behind the scenes stuff about the live action footage, it looks like how any Marvel film is made today.
Oh yeah.
But it was incredibly ahead of its time in the mid-90s.
Just like Michael Jordan in a green void and like men in green bodysuits are dancing around him.
Everything is green, the ceiling to the floor, everything green to be drawn in later. The only thing that's real is Jordan, his basketball. Anytime a character other than Michael Jordan touches a basketball, that's CG as well. And I believe like the backboard, the rim, and the net are real. Or sometimes
they... very bad CG.
Yes, yeah. No, that's the stuff. Wayne Knight as a balloon does not look so great.
Oh no, that was even criticized at the time when they were making it.
Yeah, the deformation of like live action people is ghastly in this movie.
And also like it did motion tracking and like an all digital production, though. I mean, by this point, you know, Disney had been on feature wise, they'd been digital only. They stopped doing cells a long time ago, but it was big for Warner. And I think too, that really helped them have this not take as long to make as Roger Rabbit, because they could iterate the characters in digital spaces instead of having to like print on film every time they wanted to test the animation over the people. And so other than Jordan, live action co-stars include Wayne Knight in a very underappreciated role. He's like the most actoring in this movie. His most in this. You got Bill Murray stealing the show very sleepily, and you have players Larry Bird, well, he was a coach by that time, Larry Bird, Charles Barkley, Patrick Ewing, Muggsy Bowes, Sean Bradley, and Larry Johnson. I just watched a pretty funny clip of Shaq making fun of Charles Barkley's acting in this movie.
He was trying.
Slam dunk.
Though Charles Barkley had a good point that Space Jam's a way better movie than Kazam. Like,
it really is. I wanted to go back to what you were talking about earlier, Henry, about the green void that Michael Jordan was acting in. I just realized, just thinking about it now, like so little of the live action and cartoon mix happens on like a real set or in any sort of live action world with like reality to it. And it feels like that is just a shortcut to make it as fast as possible.
Oh, totally.
Just thinking of how much care went into setting up every scene in Roger Rabbit and just like the blocking and moving the props on strings and stuff.
And the physical and matching the lighting of all of the lighting of the physical set there around. Yeah, it's very different to do it when everything is green screen. Though, I mean, yeah, when you look at like how the practice gym looks or the stadium they're in with all of its CG components, like hasn't aged
that
great.
Characters repeating.
Yes, yeah, you realize
all the cutouts in the background. Yeah,
you know, on VHS you couldn't tell they were just repeating the same like 20 characters.
I've seen that Dover boy in the other row.
But yeah, also during production, Warner was very accommodating to Jordan, building what was called the Jordan Dome next to the filming, which was a full court gym entertainment center covered with a white tarp over it. Like, it was gigantic. And in between filming, Jordan would like play full pickup games, not only with his other co-stars who were players, not Wayne Knight, but with his other co-stars and local players, including like Reggie Miller played an off-camera game against Jordan, and all to help Jordan practice, because during this summer, he'd actually played his first games before filming this, but that was at like the end of the 95 season. He was training for the 95-96 season right while he was filming this movie. So that in a way, he subsidized his training gym by doing this film. Also, Joe Pitka had a funny story about trying to play against Jordan and Jordan just dunking on him ruthlessly and just like making it feel very bad. But so they were filming all that green screen stuff. They're done with Michael Jordan. They've got all the footage. But how do you animate that, especially when you have an unmovable release date of November of 1996?
I say let the eggheads worry about it.
Well, that will take, by one count I read, 18 different studios around the globe.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. And that's why this is not a good film. There's no, you can't do that. You can't have 18 different places and cultures working on a single film. You're not going to get anything coherent. It's by design not going to be.
There's a really good Cartoon Brew oral history of this that I'm referring to here, but the...
Yeah, that was very well done. That was largely of what I had known beforehand, or either reinforcing what I knew.
And they make a good point. There's multiple times where even the folks who worked on it are like, yeah, Daffy's inconsistent scene to scene. Like, sometimes it's the Jones Daffy, sometimes it's a Freeling Daffy, sometimes it's a Clampett Daffy. It's just...
WB was very weird about that. They would have them... my friend Steve Stanchfield, who worked on the film, they would try and have him redo some of these scenes by Dave Spafford, because his studio did some animation on it, and he had animated Bugs and Daffy in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and they were trying to have him redo the Daffy. It's where Daffy's a doctor and with Michael Jordan. That's a Spafford sequence, and they were trying to have him change it back to the Jones Daffy, even though he's got the long bill like he does in Henpecked Duck and a couple of other Clampets. And Steve said, no, I'm just not going to do that. So it looks okay. I mean, when anyone says they're trying to emulate a certain director or anything, I sort of always view it. Bob Jakes put it this way. It's like you're trying to imitate another stand-up's act. And no matter what you do, you're always going to be pale imitation no matter what you do. But I think it gets the look okay in some parts, better than others. But when it's so inconsistent from scene to scene, you know, what is your mark? What bar are you trying to reach?
So maybe Henry has this, or maybe Thad might know. I mean, Chuck Jones was alive. He was brought in for Roger Rabbit. Didn't
he
quite
hated
work
this
out.
Movie.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, did he consult on it? Did he have any like public statements on it?
Well, the thing with Chuck was he was supposed to consult a bit on Roger Rabbit, but he wanted them to look more like his melted banana split versions of the characters.
Big eyelashes.
A lot of wiggling noses.
Yeah, the guy who worked on it, Tony Cervone, he can do the good Chuck Jones that everybody actually likes, the ones that made us fall in love with those characters. Well, nobody from the old guard really liked Roger Rabbit. And I got to say, you know, I'm sure you guys know my opinion on it, but I don't want to word it like this. I'm saying this as a millennial, but Roger Rabbit has not been looked up to in the business until millennials started getting into it. Like, a lot of people at the time not just the old guard, but the current people in it. You know, they just viewed it as like, you know, this splashy Michael Bay type of movie. But it did do a lot of good for the industry. You cannot take that away from it. But as far as Chuck with Space Jam, he wasn't really consulted or at all, obviously. He was doing his shorts at the time. He had a contract with Warners to do a short every year. And it was because he publicly admonished Space Jam that contract was terminated.
Ooh. Boy, they wouldn't get away with that now. That would be a Twitter hashtag.
Yeah, we'd definitely have hashtag Save Chuck.
Yeah, no.
Well, his opinion was absolutely right. It wasn't even going by which version the characters is. It was just like, he's like, well, Bugs Bunny wouldn't need Michael Jordan. He could have outsmarted them on his own.
He can beat an entire baseball team by himself. I think
exactly, yeah. And that's what he cited. He cited Freeling's baseball Bugs.
Well, also, I think he had a problem with Porky Pig saying, "I wet myself." I think he was,
yeah, I think he said something to that effect.
But, well, you know, this film owes so much to Roger Rabbit that the production, like, smartly hired a lot of animators who had worked on that film just to be like, well, how do we do Roger Rabbit? Well, let's just get a lot of those animators, though not Richard Williams. They did not get Richard Williams for this.
Oh, well, we'd still be fucking waiting for them.
R.I.P. Richard Williams, but yeah. From the thing I read on Cartoon Brew was that there was an unnamed animation director who was fired before the two credited ones came on.
I'm not sure who that might have been. I wouldn't be able to tell you that.
But the two official ones who came on after that guy are Bruce W. Smith and Tony Cervone, Cervone is, you know, he's pretty new at the time, especially to theatrical when it was time for Space Jam. I think he had just come off of being assistant director on Carrot Blanca. Though he'd soon, you know, partner with Spike Brandt, and these days he's like one of the top Warner directors of their non-theatrical movies.
He actually went on from Space Jam to do more and more things with the characters. Oh, he did the Duck Dodgers TV show with Spike Brandt.
Yeah, supervising director on that one.
And he did Tom and Jerry Tales, which it actually looks more like how you would think good Chuck Jones Tom and Jerry would look than the actual Chuck Jones Tom and Jerry.
There's 8 million Tom and Jerry movies that exist, and the Scooby-Doo
ones too.
Yeah,
those are
too,
all
like,
Spike and Tony. Yeah.
Carrot Blanca, we know it's like it was a very expensive short, and there's
$4 million.
That's crazy. I have to watch the whole thing in full, but
the Chuck Jones shorts at the time were only $1.5 million.
It's so lavish, and there's no market today for a Casablanca parody with Looney Tunes characters, but there's a very popular meme image of Bugs Bunny with his ears back with like a shot of carrot juice in front of him from that short. So like, right. My feeling when blah blah blah, it'll be a picture of Bugs Bunny from that short.
You know, if we're talking our favorite Bugs Bunny memes, I think my favorite right now is the one of Bugs nonchalantly shooting his gun as a way of just somebody sharing doing a shit post, pretty much.
Oh yeah, from Wild and Woolly Hair. Yep.
And also, like, Cervone, I think with Brandt, is the director on Scoob, or I think he's the maybe the sole director on Scoob. Not sure.
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth, yeah.
Other than Cervone, the other animation director, let's really talk about Bruce W. Smith, because he is, like...
You know, it sounds weird saying this with Space Jam, but he is the savior of the picture. So.
I think so. I think so, too. I mean, he's... If you look at his credits, and I'll go over them, but, like, he's one of the most accomplished animators of his generation, like, especially in, you know, even more impressive is that he is so talented and successful, especially in the U.S. animation field, which is not particularly lauded for its diversity. And here's Bruce W. Smith at a high level as an African American. Like, it's just incredibly impressive, like, his body of work. But, and I think, you know, I've seen things go viral that people don't realize, like, oh, this is all the same guy. It's all Bruce W. Smith who did these things that you remember, like, oh, I love Proud Family, and I also love Dr. Facilier.
That was his masterpiece. Yeah, and yeah. I'm glad they're bringing it back. We could definitely use that show again right now.
But yeah, so he got his start, like so many, in CalArts as well. He studied character animation there. His earliest credits I could find were on, you know, AM junk like Thundercats and Silverhawks. And also the Filmation Pinocchio movie, which even as an 8-year old, I was like, this sucks. Like, that's nothing on Smith. He's just taking the job.
It's one of those fake Disney movies you see in the checkout aisle for like $9.
But by the late 80s, Smith was working at Disney, and he was an animator on Roger Rabbit, as well as the Roger Short Tummy Trouble. And from there, he was pretty much, you know, in theatrical for a while. He moved on to, you know, Rock-A-Doodle, and also has, like, a lot of Rover Dangerfield as well. Not much love for Rock-A-Doodle from you, Phil?
I saw it in a theater as a kid, and I don't remember any of it.
It has a little live-action animation mashup in there too.
It's also very horny.
Oh yes, yeah. Not as horny as Lola in this movie, I think.
Oh,
it's
god, no,
can't reach that, but
it's gentlemen start your boners with this character.
But Bruce W. Smith's big break would really come when Reginald Hudlin, the filmmaker producer, he was working on the film Bebe's Kids, and he picked Smith to be the director of that film, his first animated film directing credit. And, you know, it was the first major studio African-American animated film there was, Bebe's Kids. Like, it, and, you know, it's not a hit. It, I don't think it was even profitable in theaters, but it's remembered by a generation of kids who lived through its release in 1992.
It was a vehicle for a comedian who died before the movie came out, which is insane and very sad.
Yeah, it's unfortunate timing. But so after that, Smith kind of bounced around. He worked on, you know, Sea Bear and Jamal, and also the pilot, A Cool Like That Christmas, that that I remember watching on Fox. And then Smith moved back into feature work at Warner. He worked on Pagemaster, was working on Cats Don't Dance, but then it was all hands on deck for Space Jam. As I read in an interview with Smith, he seemed to think he was just going to be at supervising animator level on it, but they tapped him as co-director pretty quickly. And he was often on set doing this. He explained the way it worked. Like, him and Cervone were on set. They're watching Michael Jordan film his scenes, and they're blocking it out, and they're trying to, like, board as they watch, like, where would Bugs go here? How does this fit with what we boarded when Michael isn't in the shot? Like, it sounds incredibly difficult. And after Space Jam, Smith would leave Warner again to go back to Disney, a supervising animator on Tarzan, Emperor's New Groove, Home on the Range, and he would also create the Disney Channel hit The Proud Family, which aired 52 episodes plus a couple movies, TV movies. And after that, a supervising animator on Princess and the Frog. His Dr. Facilier is one of my all-time favorite just characters to watch move. Like, he's just, God, everything about Dr. Facilier, I love him. One of my all-time favorite Disney villains.
It's a very gorgeous movie.
Yeah, and I guess the end of it, too.
Yeah, it's the last 2D movie for Disney.
Sad. And yeah, he's had a lot of varied credits ever since then. You know, Warner job here, Disney job there. He just won an Oscar for co-directing the short Hair Love. Mm. I watched a sad video of him talking about how up until early this year, he was planning to work in an animation studio started by Kobe Bryant. Like,
that's right. Oscar winner,
yes,
Kobe Bryant.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that's not happening now. And now he's working on, you know, bringing back the Proud Family as part of Disney Plus. So that's, I'm glad he's, I would hate to think they'd bring back Proud Family without him. I mean, contractually, it might even be, you know, like, they could probably do it without the creator. They're Disney, of course they could. What am I saying? But yeah, I mean, is there anything else in Smith's profile you'd want to spotlight that?
No, not particularly. I just, you know, I don't know him personally, but all I hear is good things about him. So, you know, he's just one of these hardworking guys who's done a lot of good, but doesn't get a lot of notoriety for it.
I'm hoping, you know, after his Oscar win, maybe more people are learning his name and realizing, like, he's a 35-year veteran of the business, not just like a guy who just appeared with his Oscar winning short.
Insane like a runaway train, I'm in your lane, like it's only 3 seconds to score to win the game. Came to bring the ultimate pain up on the brain, untamed. You won't like it when I change into a type strange, make low maniacal, monster in the game. And I got my eye on you, dead shot aim, as free throws keep coming down like rain. You feeling me, I'm feeling you, the monster gang. I'm telling you,
Pass me the rock, now I'm headed to the basket. Get up on my way is what you better do. My tactics is unsportsmanlike conduct, you better ask it. Don't get no better than this. You catch my drip, you get stripped by ball handlers, ruled by swag hammer. Danger, you dealing with official hoop banger. With hang time, like a coat hanger. Jump with thunderous 360 degree tight dunks. What up, Dr. Monster Funk? Lightning strikes, the court lights get dim. Supreme competition is about to begin. Above the rim, finessing it moves is animated. Once I get the ball in, I can't be deflated. A rugged paw, my mom stars is getting money. When clicks get the bugging, I'm snatching up their bunnies. Every step I take shakes the ground. I make you break your ankle, son, shake you down. This is my planet, about business, the best that ever done it. Can I get a witness? A cumulus cloud bring darkness up above. You in it for the money or in it for the love? MJ, 23 ways to make a pay. Lounging in the mothership back around my way. A 28 light years old. If the refs get political, dribble